Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Errol Yabuke.
And Errol, you know I've got love and affection and respect for you, including your Texas roots. We've got a couple stories out of Texas this week, specifically from the state government when it comes to women and immigrants. So I'll let the listeners guess how happy that news is.
They're doozies. We'll also debate the pronunciation of AUKUS, A-U-K-U-S, while mispronouncing tons and tons of French in the process.
And maybe even some UN acronyms. Finally, we'll touch on Galaxy Brain communication strategies and the original Galaxy Brain, Sun Tzu.
Oh, gee. All right, Mike. All right. This was definitely a fun one.
Let's get into it. Welcome, Errol. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Mike. I like your new setup in your attic. You're looking very professional, which of course people can't see.
But I trust everyone can hear how professional I look though.
They can hear how professional you look. I like how seamlessly you said that. how are you, man?
I'm good. This is our first ever daytime recording of News and Brews.
I know there's like light in the background. I'm also curious to see what brew you have going on.
Yeah, well, it almost feels like we're like getting away with something, you know?
Yeah, this is my lunchtime hour, guys. I promise. Well, I mean, I'll just give it away. I'm rocking some Topo Chico right now.
All right.
Which anybody from Texas knows, you drink Topo Chico like water.
So I'm also going back to my roots with a Maryland brew today. But I've got the Dogfish Head Pumpkin Ale.
Oh, you're winning.
That's pumpkin, P-U-N-K-I-N, as in pumpkin chunkin, which...
that doesn't help with the explanation at all. Pumpkin, as in pumpkin chunkin. It's you like, know, that's, it, those are it, just words, made worth, up words.
It's worth a Google for our listeners. But it's excellent. It's a brown ale infused with pumpkin and spices. And this is my first pumpkin beer of the season, which is really gratifying for me.
It's like the Starbucks of beer. Well, full support.
What I'll say about this one specifically is there's always the balance between how much pumpkin are you going to get and how much ale are you going to get. And this one is really nice. It leans a little bit more toward the ale. It's a little bit less like overwhelmingly pumpkin, which I really enjoy. I'm also going to put in a little bit of a plug in a soapbox for, obviously it's pumpkin spice season right now. No complaints. Love that. I think it's something our society and culture does really well of restricting this flavor to a couple months in the fall for like really no reason other than it would get kind of old otherwise, right? Like we can get oranges at the grocery store 12 months a year. Like we have the technology to have pumpkin spice whenever we want it. And we've just made a really responsible decision, I think, as a society. What I'll advocate for though is we need, there's a flavor profile that's just underrepresented, I think, in this season. And that is the apple cider donut flavor.
Mm.
Like there's plenty of apples and I think there's a good amount of cider, but the apple cider donut is just a unique mix of deliciousness that I want to be a part of pretty much everything I eat and drink in this period. So we'll just put that plug in.
Yeah, no, full support for the plug. I mean, anybody who spent any time in New England knows that apple cider donuts are like a breakfast, lunch, and dinner thing. And coincidentally, it goes well with breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So
yeah,
it's good.
With that stipulated, should we get into the first round?
It was a really great soapbox. and yes, let's get into the first round.
All right, we'll start in Texas. And bear with me because there's a lot to unpack with this first story.
It's been a couple weeks for Texas, I feel like.
It has. And we've got a couple of Texas stories too. But this first one, you know, so we didn't get a chance a few weeks back to cover the Supreme Court approval of SB 8, the Texas law that went into effect at the start of this month, restricting abortion rights and really eliminating abortion rights due to the week we took off from recording at that time. But most of our listeners probably know this law is basically a crossover special between 1984 and The Handmaid's Tale. So any citizen inside or outside of Texas who suspects an abortion being performed after about 6 weeks of pregnancy can sue anyone associated with the procedure, like doctors, nurses, secretaries, janitors, transportation providers, and anyone else who could be considered aiding and abetting. Successful plaintiffs will be awarded $10,000, offset by a fine in the same amount the defendant has to pay. And even if the lawsuit is not successful, there is no mechanism for defendants to recoup their legal fees. So that's all to say this law is an imposition of a draconian, borderline theocratic restriction on women's freedom and control over their own bodies, with an enforcement mechanism of neighbors spying on neighbors that honestly would make the KGB proud.
Well said.
Earlier this month, the Supreme Court declined to invalidate the law without ruling at the time on its constitutionality, right? Specifically because it is enforced by private citizens. So they essentially said the challenge to the law was filed against the state, but the state isn't responsible for enforcing it, so they wouldn't accept the challenge. So that
it was such a technicality. I mean, it was such a cop-out. The hope is that there's some room for this to change over time because they didn't rule on the constitutionality, but just the fact that they issued this midnight non-decision was just terrible.
Absolutely. And it's a reflection of the very purposeful strategy on the organizations behind the law to skirt judicial review. Anyway, fast forward to this past Saturday when Dr. Alan Braid, an OBGYN in San Antonio, published an op-ed in the Washington Post saying he had performed an abortion this month after the law went into effect in violation of the new law. And we'll link the op-ed in the show notes in case folks didn't have a chance to see it. It is worth a read. It's a powerful personal testimony from a doctor who's been practicing since 1972, the year before Roe v. Wade made abortion legal across the country. By Tuesday, so that op-ed came out on Saturday. By Tuesday, Dr. Braid had been sued by two different individuals under the law, one in Arkansas and another in Illinois. What's interesting is that no one in Texas, including the anti-abortion groups who have been pushing the law all along, was planning to sue this doctor. And in fact, they're upset that these lawsuits have been filed. And that is a direct reflection of how cynical this whole enterprise is, because it rests entirely on fear to make the law effective and this like Kafka-esque procedural loophole to keep it on the books. The fact that the suits have been filed and that the law is therefore now being enforced by something other than fear and threats means it can now be challenged head on in court. And since it clearly violates the precedent set by Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, you would expect it to have a good chance of being struck down as soon as the court gets around to assessing its constitutionality.
It is a really fascinating and deeply personal op-ed that he wrote, and I would commend it on everyone. And I think that this is just such an interesting part of this story, that they didn't actually, the proponents of this law did not actually want to litigate this as part of the judicial system. They wanted this to be a Kafka-esque crossover between, what did you say, The Handmaid's Tale and 1984.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the goal, and he was essentially calling bullshit on that.
Yeah, and interestingly, the plaintiffs are not anti-abortion activists in this case.
What?
They are like former lawyers. I think they actually were both lawyers at one point and have been disbarred for various reasons. One of them has overtly said they're pro-choice. So they are sort of playing into the same. No, they just understand the same strategy that the organizers of the law do, right? They understand that the only way to have a good chance of getting this law overturned is to bring a suit in court. And because the law empowers literally any citizen in the nation to do it, they're just doing it.
Okay, that's fascinating. I didn't know that part of it. So it's like somebody who thinks that this law is stupid is actually suing under the law, because you have to have some sort of judicial process.
Exactly.
Through which to adjudicate this. Wow, that's fascinating.
And so, of course, it's not a given that this judicial review process will go in a positive direction, right? Because on the Supreme Court, you have conservatives with the 6-3 majority, but it means that there could be some relief and a restoration of freedom for women in Texas all the way up until December 1st of this year, because the Supreme Court just also announced that on that date, it will hear the case of Mississippi's heartbeat bill, which is referred to as the Dobbs case. This is a much more direct challenge to Roe v. Wade, taking it head on and making the claim that there should not be a constitutional right to an abortion. And honestly, it's not looking great. Listeners know that we live in DC, and because of that, I've gotten a bit of a briefing on the Dobbs case by osmosis. So I wore an aggressive RBG themed mask to a parents event for one of my kids' schools. And it turned out another parent was in the process of writing the amicus brief for a major association on the Dobbs case. So we talked about it for a while, and in a nutshell, given the makeup of the court, it's not looking
at your
great,
kids' right? after school event.
Exactly. You know, reading between the lines, and I think you can glean this, some of this from the way that the court ruled on the Texas case. You know, the Texas case was 5-4 with Roberts joining the liberals in dissent. And he himself, the Chief Justice, is known to place a lot of weight on precedent, right? This principle of stare decisis. So hope number one is that he will not vote to overturn a 40-year precedent of Roe v. Wade. That still leaves us one vote short, of course. The next best hope, it seems, is Kavanaugh. And I think a lot of the briefs that are coming in, a lot of the arguments that are being crafted are aimed squarely at Kavanaugh, to some extent Gorsuch as well. What's interesting is the week before the Texas ruling was issued, you can go back and listen. Actually, Pod Save America had a Supreme Court watcher on as a guest. And this was before the abortion ruling was really in the news. They were talking entirely about other stuff. Specifically, they were talking about the CDC's eviction moratorium, which that prior week, right before the Texas SB 8 ruling, Kavanaugh kind of took a spiritual loss in the decision. He didn't like the procedure under which it had been brought and didn't want to flex to allow improper procedure, but he was forced to basically be inconsistent in his legal principles because of the real world harm that would have resulted from an immediate cancellation of the moratorium. So he essentially agreed to give the CDC like a 30-day window to leave the moratorium in place. There's no legal basis for doing something.
Yeah,
like
I remember that, right? This.
So, you know, either something legally is constitutional or it isn't. But he was sort of forced into this like pragmatic middle ground, which he was clearly not happy about. So my suspicion is that coming off of that, he saw this Texas SB 8 appeal come before him, didn't like the procedure, you know, didn't think that it was sort of following the proper legal approach as a result of this strategy to skirt judicial review overtly, but still he didn't think it was sound legally. And so he wasn't willing to sort of compromise his legal principles again in order to put a stay on this law. But if that is the case, and you know, it really was, he may, you know, sort of think in his heart of hearts that the SB 8 is not constitutional, but that, you know, he wouldn't overturn it at the time because of this sort of cynical, horrific peer-to-peer enforcement mechanism. He may still be willing to uphold the longstanding precedent when it comes to ruling on the constitutionality of one or both of these laws.
Hope springs eternal.
Hope springs eternal. That being said, we know Kavanaugh is not just a legal creature, but a political one too, given the arc of his career. So, you know, it's pretty dismal.
And I think this is why you're not only seeing folks targeting Kavanaugh and Justice Roberts and things like that, but also saying Congress, it's time to put this into law. Because I think one of the issues with the Supreme Court is that they rule in the absence of kind of legislation. So there could be legislation that makes abortion the law of the land and the right to an abortion the law of land. Of course, that could be challenged in the Supreme Court eventually, but you would then be challenging a piece of legislation that would then challenge the separation of, you know, the judicial branch and the legislative branch, which is a much bigger bridge to cross than challenging a piece of Supreme Court precedent. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like there's an effort to handle this through the judicial system, but then I think there's going to be growing calls, especially after December 1st, like you pointed out, there's going to be growing calls to say like, okay, well, Democrats still, for the next few months at least, have control of both houses of Congress and the White House. Then things like the filibuster really come into play a lot more on whether or not they'll actually be able to do something about it.
Right. So we can move on from the depressing Stephen Breyer retirement conversation to the depressing filibuster conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it's all not great. In the meantime, I think there's other Texas stories.
There sure is. So we've covered on this show the string of horrific events in Haiti really over the last decade, but especially this year, including the assassination of the president this summer, followed weeks later by an earthquake, and days after that, a direct hit from Tropical Storm Grace. You now have Haiti trying to recover from these natural disasters amid the breakdown in governance, meaning large parts of the country are under the control of gangs. Tens of thousands of people have had to flee their homes, according to the New York Times. And so it's just a lot of human misery happening in Haiti. Against this backdrop, we're seeing a massive increase in Haitian people without immigration documents trying to cross into the U.S. Specifically, Border Patrol has intercepted in 2019 about 2,000 Haitians, in 2020 about 4,400, and so far this fiscal year, which ends at the end of this month, 28,000. Note that that's out of, that 28,000 number is out of 1.5 million people intercepted at the border this year in total. Right. So a relatively small piece of the whole, but still a massive increase from where we've been.
Yeah, from where we've been on Haitians. When we think about folks coming to the southern border, you think about, well, you used to think about Mexicans in the 90s and the 2000s. And now there's actually more Mexicans returning to Mexico than there are coming to the United States, according to the data. And so it sort of shifted to then Central Americans, Hondurans, Guatemalans, El Salvadorans, some Nicaraguans, et cetera. You know, I was down in Mexico in, I think it was early 2019, doing some research on this kind of stuff. And there was just starting to be this kind of Haitian component. You know, it's not an insignificant barrier that Haitians don't speak Spanish by and large and English. And so it's, you know, it's sort of making a harrowing journey even more harrowing.
Yeah.
So that this increase should be seen within that context, not just sort of the real numbers.
Here. Yeah. And so this week, this has really started to come to a head. It's estimated that about 14,000 Haitian migrants have gathered at the Texas border town of Del Rio. And while the Biden administration has extended temporary protected status for Haitians already living in the U.S., who number about 150,000, that protection does not apply to new arrivals. So the U.S. announced that it would resume deportation flights to bring these people back to Haiti under Title 42, which is the emergency public health order that allows the U.S. To turn away large numbers of migrants during the pandemic. Then on Tuesday of this week, images and video began to emerge from Del Rio showing Border Patrol agents on horseback threatening and charging migrants. So some outlets reported they were whipping migrants, which really kind of raises the question of who approves the whip budget of Homeland Security. But DHS has opened an internal investigation, and it looks more likely the agents were basically brandishing their horses' reins like whips or lassos in sort of an intimidation move in the direction of migrants, including children. Either way, the images and video are really hard to look at, and it's just a really scary situation there at the border.
Look, this is not the Trump administration. I think that an internal DHS investigation has some chance of actually figuring out what happened and holding some folks accountable. Whereas if we were a year ago right now, I would have said no chance in hell that that's even a possibility. Let's just all agree it's an inappropriate thing to charge migrants on horseback. I'm assuming there's lots of people that would disagree with me. I'm not sure that they listen to News and Brews, but you know that it's worth acknowledging that folks out there might disagree with what we're saying here. The broader implications, Mike, for me are, look, the usage of this temporary statute or rule or whatever it was to deport people under because it's in a global pandemic is a little bit of a cynical move, if you ask me, because I think that there's certainly still a pandemic. Haiti has incredibly low vaccination rates and there's certainly sort of the risk of that. But I'm guessing that's not why they were put on planes and deported. I think that was the most convenient legal excuse that they could have to fund the planes and the roundup and all that stuff.
And on that point, I don't think we're really even hearing that as a policy excuse from the administration. I think you're hearing more, and this, I don't know that this is attributable to the administration directly or just sort of advocates on one side or the other, but more that the incentive structure is really complex with these issues. Right. And to not turn migrants away would create an incentive and, you know, by word of mouth that more
totally.
Would come, you know, that it's a particularly difficult situation with the Haitians, not just because of the language barrier, which you mentioned, but also because some of these folks are coming from Haiti directly or nearly directly, you know, in the wake of these recent disasters. Others are people who actually fled in the wake of the 2010 earthquake. You know, other the fallout from that, and have been in places like Brazil or Chile or other countries since then, and conditions there have gotten so bad for them that they're now moving north.
Yeah, totally. all great points. I think the push and pull factors involved in human mobility, are all of them are at play here. And there has been an increase in the number of migrants who were coming north to the southern U.S. border during the Biden administration, which it's hard to attribute everything to, like, oh, this is a new administration that has signaled that they want to treat, you know, migrants with humanity and whatever the sort of wording was at the beginning of the administration. But it's undeniable that there is a larger number. I think what you have seen out of the Biden-Harris administration is they are trying to also address why people are leaving, at least in the Central American context. They now have a strategy for this. It's by and large not a bad strategy. It addresses, I think, what some of the root causes of why people are leaving. That having been said, addressing the root causes of why people are leaving in Haiti or Central America or elsewhere is a really long-term thing. And in the meantime, you've got a natural disaster, you've got a political crisis, and you've just got decades and decades of hardship. And so the decision to use the mechanism, the COVID-related mechanism, was sort of a convenient one, I think, for DHS. I mean, they have to have a reason to put people on planes, because according to international law, anybody who shows up has the right to seek asylum. And so a lot of these folks know that language, and they would have arrived knowing, however you say it in French or Haitian Creole, like, I am here to seek asylum because I am being persecuted, whatever. Like, under international law, you have to sort of process those people. Now, the Trump administration had flaunted international law by this sort of so-called remain in Mexico policy, which the Biden-Harris administration hasn't fully gotten rid of yet, which I think is problematic. They're still trying to figure it out, how they're going to manage the border in a more humane way. I believe them when they say that that's what they're trying to do, as evidenced by these disturbing images. It's not totally working yet. And they have a lot more, I think, to figure out before we have some semblance of kind of regular and orderly flows in and out of the United States to the South.
Balancing all of these different considerations, if you were making policy in this area, what is the right way to balance the incentive structure with the humanitarian considerations, with the implications, you know, for broader policy trajectory here and now?
Look, I think that there need to be more resources going to the border, but not for enforcement. I think the resources need to be on processing. The reason that there were thousands and thousands of Haitians under a bridge is not because we needed more border agents to ride horses across the desert. It was because we don't have enough immigration judges. We don't have enough people to process. There is a process, right? So if you're a Haitian who has, you know, made your way irregularly through Mexico and you're at the United States and you say, I'm here to claim asylum, there is a way to adjudicate that claim and process it and, like, assign credible threat and all this. And if your claim fails, then you get on a plane and you go home.
Right.
Right. I think what is missing from this situation is that we are not following the principles. We're not following the principles of international law and quite frankly, our own. There's limited evidence that things like what happened this week, putting Haitians on planes without being processed, there's limited evidence that that kind of stuff is actually a deterrent to migrants. And so that being the only strategy, this was, in addition to the inhumanity, this was a big problem with the Trump strategy, was that, like, the stuff that they were doing, there's no evidence that it actually works in achieving the goal that they're setting out to achieve. So, like, let's process people, and those that have credible, you know, claims can stay and they go through a system, and those that are not get deported. That's the way that the system works.
That's,
I got
a
little riled,
because,
up there, Mike.
Rightly so. But it's a great point, because the complaint you hear a lot from folks on the anti-immigration side of the debate is, well, you know, it's such a leaky system, and people who shouldn't be here are just able to come in and stay indefinitely. And that is a problem. That is against the law. But to your point, it's because we don't have the capacity to actually do the processing and follow the law, including international law.
Yeah. So it's like we're basically building proverbial walls and trying to keep people out, and then not, for those that do get through, not having enough capacity to process them. And then we're wondering why people are crossing illegally. And it's, none of this is surprising from that perspective.
Well, moving on to, you know, at least like neutral news, maybe. So the FDA late last week issued two decisions on booster vaccine shots. One saying that they did not authorize or did not give the nod to booster shots for anyone who has received a vaccine. And I hesitated on saying authorized because this panel is an advisory panel. It's ultimately up to the administrator of the FDA, who has not yet issued a final decision on this, but presumably will.
But it's unlikely to go against the panel's advice.
Right. The follow the science administration, I don't think will do that. However, they did, by a unanimous decision, approve booster shots for high-risk individuals. So the elderly, those with comorbidities, things like that. First, just what was your reaction on seeing those couple of pieces of news?
Well, you missed the other one too, where it's not boosters, but Pfizer has apparently been approved for kids 5 and older.
Well, not approved. I think Pfizer showed encouraging results in their tests and said they would soon seek approval.
Thank you. Yes, that was the most encouraging news to me as someone with a, you know, 4-year-old whose next birthday they will be eligible. So hopefully by her next birthday, that's available. Look, I think this is the way the process is supposed to work on the boosters. We should look at the evidence. And if there is a demonstrable reason that we should be getting booster shots, then I trust the scientists who are nonpartisan and science-based to be advising on this. And I think the fact that they advised against it makes me trust the system even more, because it's not like everybody's in the take of the pharmaceutical industry and we want to just get more shots into arms because it will make them money. Like, there's actually, you know, theoretically a rhyme or reason to this. A side benefit, and we're going to talk about the UN in a little bit, a side benefit of this, Mike, is that, and maybe an ironic one, is the fact that boosters are not getting rolled out in a significant way in the US could actually help us on the international stage.
Is seeing some of the coverage, particularly on the left, of people being really upset that booster shots aren't going to anyone, was not the way I felt.
Like, no, it wasn't the way I felt either.
It actually, like, I think it is a good thing that like more pharmaceuticals for everyone, everywhere, and all the time isn't like the trajectory of decision making.
Yeah,
I think, and I also had immediately to the same thought you did, which is like the administration has been very open about the fact that they have essentially stockpiled or already ordered enough doses to cover booster shots for everyone.
Yeah,
which means we have a surplus now, and that creates some opportunity. So, what are your thoughts on that opportunity?
I think the opportunity is global. The UN Secretary General Guterres has said that the goal is by this time next year, 70% of the world is fully vaccinated. And the only way that that's going to happen is if we use that surplus where it's actually needed to get people vaccinated. When the booster is needed for us, I'm sure it will be available. The last thing that the Biden administration wants to do, and not to get cynically political here, but the last thing they want to do 12 months before or less than 12 months before a midterm election is like, oh, sorry, guys, we don't have enough stock, right?
You know,
for the boosters.
So I have some contrarian thoughts on this, which sort of goes to my like suppressed galaxy brain comms person deep down, which is I actually don't know if a little bit of scarcity would be the worst thing. There are so many people in our country.
Oh, interesting.
Who amid abundance of available vaccine supplies are resistant to it. And I think part of that is on the assumption that whenever I want it, I'll just go down to the pharmacy and it'll be there.
Oh, you went all behavioral economics on us.
What if that weren't the case, right? What if there were a little bit more urgency and we actually had a policy that said, you know what? The people in our country who really want this have gotten it. We're going to shift our focus toward vaccinating the world now.
You know, if the future of the human race weren't at risk, I'd say let's do a randomized control trial on this.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing you hear in thinking about this international need is the last mile problem, right, with vaccine distribution, which says, you know, we can get as many vaccines as we want to for health ministries around the world, but a relatively low percentage of vaccine doses that have actually been distributed have gotten into arms at this point. Yeah. And there's this issue of the last mile problem. And this is an area where, like, I just think this is such an opportunity for specifically American business to step up.
Yeah.
Potentially the military as well, right? Amazing logistical capabilities on the military's part, but American business, right? We have so many of the world's leading shipping and distribution companies to assist in this effort and really create a presence for us in a way that is unequivocally positive around the world, just through a relatively small amount of largesse.
Yeah. I think they're ready. I mean, there's lots of talk of public-private partnerships, and, you know, UPS and FedEx are all seem to be primed for this. I think that they're kind of waiting. I don't know the ins and outs of whatever policy they're waiting on, but there's a little bit of wait and see on this. But just today in the Wall Street Journal, there was a full page advertisement sponsored in part by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that was basically endorsing this 70% global vaccination rate by this time next year. And it's telling that it was the Chamber of Commerce. It wasn't just the One campaign, which is also on there, which is an advocacy group. It wasn't just the U.S. Global Leadership Coalition, which is an advocacy group. It was the Chamber of Commerce saying, like, we're ready. Our members are ready. Let's do this. So let's hope that they can. Yeah, let's hope that those forces can align and that we can actually accomplish this. I mean, talk about a moonshot.
Totally. Yeah, let's put some investment into something besides full page ads in The Wall Street Journal.
Sometimes that's useful, though, you know, galaxy brain comps.
Hey, Mike. It got him onto the pod. Finally, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Nicki Minaj and specifically Nicki Minaj's cousin, and more specifically, Nicki Minaj's cousin's friends, and most specifically, Nicki Minaj's cousin's friends' testicles.
So this is a story that for about 3 days I just tried not to pay attention to, and it was impossible not to pay attention to it. Because, like, Nicki Minaj is such an interesting character, but it was just like everything was about Nicki Minaj's
everything
cousin's friend's testicles.
And so it was her cousin friend in Trinidad and Tobago, and so you had, like, Fauci investigating this. You had the health minister of Trinidad coming out and making claims.
What was the story, though? He got vaccinated.
The story was Nicki Minaj has been a, let's say, vaccine skeptic, and has been sort of in the do your own research crowd. And it turns out that research in this case means a third hand story from a friend of a distant relative in another country. And she sent this tweet out that said, my cousin's friend in Trinidad took the vaccine. His testicles became enlarged, and eventually his fiance called off their wedding. I think that hearing that enlargement of the testicles could be a side effect may have just increased the percentage of 16-year-old boys getting this shot up to about 100%. I mean, it's just like, so obviously one of these stories that, like, if you're at a backyard barbecue, you expect to hear this sort of thing, right? And I mean, Nicki Minaj is not a public health expert. I don't think it's right to expect that she would behave like one, but she does.
But when you have a zillion followers,
exactly,
on Twitter,
she has a following of a million people who are looking to her for guidance on this. And I, you know, again, like, it's sort of a depressing thought about where we are and how decision making works for a lot of people. But
if, like, your uncle with 3 followers on Twitter tweets this, like, who cares?
Right.
I'm sure it'll get, you know, retweeted by a Russian bot. But other than that, like, it's not a big deal. If Nicki Minaj tweets this out, like, unsubstantiated medical claims that are related to vaccines, like, she's a public figure. Sorry, Nicki.
I mean, the thing that is hard about this is also the thing that is, like, delightful about it, which is, like, it's just so funny to talk about balls. And so, like, you had, like, so much mileage out of this story, and everyone commenting on every late night show, every podcast that thinks it's a late night show.
Fair. Well, yeah. Should we get on to our main story of the day?
Let's get into our main story. So So this week is the meeting of the UN General Assembly. And I thought it would be, so this is the first one under Biden's presidency. Tuesday of this week gave his first ever speech to the UN General Assembly as president. I thought it would be useful, though, for us to talk about some of the context leading up to the meeting, because it has felt like there's just been a lot of international kind of foreign policy news coming out in the last week, which I suspect has some relation to the fact that this meeting is happening, and in other ways just kind of sets the stage for it.
Yeah, I think that's right, Mike. I mean, the UN General Assembly is an excuse for a lot of international action. Mm-hmm. Some of that action happens at the UN General Assembly. A lot of it happens what they would call on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. On the sidelines usually means like in the couple of weeks leading up to, and like sometimes literally on the sidelines, like at a hotel across the street from the General Assembly, and usually like a week or two after. And so this, one of the major things going into the UN General Assembly this year was that the US and Australia and the United Kingdom announced a defense pact. And they announced it September 15th, last Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And it was to much sort of fanfare, or so they thought. It was essentially a trilateral security pact that never named China specifically, but it was a fairly obvious attempt to counter Chinese influence generally.
Before we get into the specifics of it, why do you think the administration keeps like tiptoeing around China as a focus of its policy in the Pacific?
I think this is, you mean not like
not naming them
China
specifically, right?
So I think that part of this is plausible deniability. And the reason that that is important is because the Chinese leadership is very, very wary of international opinion. And the one of the things that they hate the most is being named and shamed. If this were the Trump administration, that's all they did was name and shame. They didn't actually have any substance. And so what you're seeing is a lot of substance, also not being like China's the devil at the same time. And so went out of their way, though, to say like, oh, this is not, I think it was the Australian Prime Minister or Biden or somebody was like, this is not about China. This is about strengthening our partnership. And it's like, you're giving these guys an out.
Right. And that's obviously not true is the other problem with it, right? Like,
but is that a problem though?
It's a problem because like China knows why they're doing this.
So here's the difference though, is like in response to this, some, you know, senior Chinese Communist Party official, a foreign minister, somebody was like, this is a bad thing. We don't like this.
Right.
As opposed to Xi Jinping threatening to cut off trade relations with, you know, all three countries, as opposed to moving Chinese submarines into contested waters, as opposed, you know, like
it's just, you know, what it is it feels obfuscatory. It feels like they're just not talking about the elephant in the room, which just doesn't seem like a good way to govern.
Or does it though? I mean,
this is maybe why I'm not in foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's diplomacy involved here. I think mm-hmm. that there's geopolitics involved. I think there's a little bit of Sun Tzu involved, a little bit of like the board game Risk involved.
Sun Tzu is the original galaxy brain.
I think that it was fairly obvious, but it doesn't need to be like pie in the face obvious. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's geopolitical reasons why that would be the case.
All that being said, it is less important exactly what language they use in announcing this than what is in the agreement.
Yes, definitely. I mean, we probably don't remember this because, you know, we have the memories of goldfish, but early in the Biden-Harris administration, there was actually a meeting with senior Chinese officials in Alaska. And we actually talked about this on the previous version of News and Brews. And, you know, we kind of got owned in a way by... They came out guns blazing, diplomatic guns blazing, and we were caught flat-footed. And we just didn't want that to happen again. So needless to say, China is not a fan of this, a UK-US. By the way, what are we calling this? Are we calling this AUKUS?
I'm calling it AUKUS.
Is that what they called it?
I don't know.
Okay, sure. But I think it's worth, you know, getting into just one of the details of this agreement, which I think is the one that has blown up the most in the run-up to UNGA. And that is that a big part of this trilateral security pact was that the UK and the US were going to sort of help Australia with their nuclear sub capacity, which Australia said, thank you very much. We're going to then cancel this French diesel electric submarine agreement that we had, which, by the way, had cost overruns and was significantly delayed. And there was a lot of sort of mutual unhappiness with the French-Australian deal in the first place. But essentially, Australia said, we're going to cancel that contract and we're now going to go with the Brits and the Americans. And so the French response was also very predictable on this. And I think if we had thought about whether or not they'd be pissed if the contract was canceled, then maybe we would have talked to them beforehand. And I think that that was just a diplomatic missed opportunity. It's a $90 billion contract. And I think more importantly than that, you know, France is a country with, you know, they're a member of the Security Council. They're America's oldest ally. They came to our rescue multiple times, including in our War of Independence. And I think it was a big faux pas. You know, probably what piqued their vous savez quoi was the most was the fact that they didn't seem to see this coming.
I see what you did there. So you said that their response was predictable. And of course, this isn't something you're going to be happy about. And like their initial response of canceling a party, I think was surely predictable. Do you think recalling their ambassadors?
That was not predicted.
Yeah, that seems really extreme.
So it's the first time since 1790 that that has happened.
Yeah.
And it was certainly the diplomatic nuclear option. And they went right for it. Just, I think that just goes to show that this is not a passing thing. I mean, sort of setting aside that the agreement actually makes a lot of sense from a national security and geopolitical perspective for the United States, for the UK, for Australia, certainly positioning great powers vis-a-vis China, all of that sort of makes reasonable sense. But it just was a big unforced error to piss off France like this.
So this putting aside point that you just made, I think is a reflection of what has frustrated me about some of the coverage on this, which is I was trying to research like what this agreement was all about, what some of the details were, what the price tag was, what the strategic implications were.
And it was all France.
It was all France. It was all like France canceling parties. Some of the coverage on the left rightly framed the news about the French being mad as like silly relative to, say, our final airstrike of the Afghanistan war taking out an aid worker and a bunch of kids. But that came at the expense of like totally ignoring the significance of the deal itself geopolitically, right? Whether you are emphasizing the French response or you are not dismissing it, but, you know, speaking about it as overwrought, nobody's talking about the difference between having nuclear versus diesel-powered submarines in the Indian Ocean, right? Nobody's talking about the implications on non-proliferation and what this may mean for other nuclear powers who have other allies.
That doesn't get clicks, Mike.
Right. And no one really was even talking about the implications for the UNGA, which I think may go some way to explaining why the French response was so extreme. Also, the fact that, you know, it's an iterated game, right? Yep. We are in the middle of a lot of conversations with France about a lot of different things. And, you know, it's like the old Seinfeld analogy of like, they want to have hand in the relationship. This is a way to get hand.
There's a French election next year, and the outcome of which is far from certain. And, you know, there's far-right extremists, Marine Le Pen being one of them, who's running to be the head of state in France again. And so I think that there's a lot going on in the bilateral relationship. There's a lot going on domestically in France. Them being annoyed was probably predicted by the Biden-Harris administration. I think the degree to which this just absolutely blew up from you know, bilateral perspective was not anticipated.
Yeah.
It's worth mentioning as well. So obviously there's like an Australian leader who's involved in this and a British leader. And the Australian, Morrison, was like very, you know, even about the whole thing. And Boris Johnson, who is not known for his tact, came to, he's been in the United States for UNGA. We call it UNGA in the biz, Mike. He came down to meet with Biden, and I'm going to read the exact quote of what he said outside of the U.S. Capitol. He said, "I just think it's time for some of our dearest friends around the world to prene un grip about this and donnez-moi un break."
That's incredible.
I mean, kudos to the guy. I mean, lots of people knock him for lots of things, but I mean, the communication and just like the, oh no, the je ne sais quoi. Good on him.
I'm just glad that there's ample French on this episode of the podcast without me having to say any of it. So I appreciate that.
This has been a theme of ours recently. I think we both do it really badly.
Getting, you know, back to this, so the AUKUS and the French response to it is one piece of context going into the General Assembly. Another is that it's coming on the heels, of course, of the U.S. exit from Afghanistan. It came out last week that the last drone strike of the war during the evacuation was a mistake. So
yeah, I mean, the one of the generals who was in charge of the operation came out and said literally that, said this was a quote-unquote tragic mistake that quote-unquote inadvertently killed 10 civilians, including children.
Yeah, and I want to give some credit here to Matthew Akins of the New York Times, who really was reporting this in the immediate wake of the strike itself, even as U.S. military brass was saying that there may have been some collateral damage, but this took out a high-value planner of, you know, the ISIS-K organization. And it turns out that that was all incorrect.
They actually cited his research on this and his investigation. And I mean, look, it just goes to show the incredible importance of investigative journalism.
Yeah, totally. And not just to do the forensic work of, you know, seeing that there was no secondary explosion suggesting that there had been explosives in the car and things like that, but also to paint the human portrait of who the target of this strike really was, right? It turned out it was a humanitarian and an aid worker who was employed by a Western NGO and had been, you know, delivering food to refugees earlier that day, and the tanks in his car were water for his family. And it was just really tragic on the level of a few deaths, and such a heartbreaking microcosm of this like disastrous era in U.S. foreign policy that essentially came to an end with this strike, hopefully.
Yeah. And you know, it's worth taking a second, I think, Mike, to think about what is happening in Afghanistan now. We're sort of, I don't know if I wanted to call it optimistic, but there was some kind of sliver of hope that maybe this Taliban was going to be different than the last Taliban. And I think that that's showing to be pretty much not true. This Taliban is certainly interested. They're more geopolitically savvy, and they're certainly interested in geopolitical recognition, which we'll talk about in a second. Mm-hmm. But they closed the Ministry for Women. Schools are back open, but girls were not invited back. Mm. There's a new cabinet that they announced, which is pretty much all the same people, including someone, Sirhuddin Haqqani, who's the Minister of Interior, which means he's basically the head of everything internal, including the, you know, FBI, that whatever their version of the FBI is. And this is Haqqani of the Haqqani network.
Like the militant network.
Yes. I mean, he's like the leader of the Haqqani network, yeah, with close ties to Al-Qaeda. He's on the FBI wanted list. I think it was just a snub in the face of everyone that he was given a ministerial post. I would say the last thing is, you know, we still haven't figured out how to have eyes and ears on the ground. UN agencies are still working. Some international NGOs are still there, but it's unclear whether the actions of the Taliban are ever going to come to light, you know, in their human rights abuses. I think it's a great role for the UN, since we're talking about the UN, to make sure that they're highlighting some of these human rights abuses, but it's far from clear that we will have that insight into Afghanistan, let alone insight on where the bad guys are and how they're mobilizing and how they're getting together.
Yeah, so things are not great in Afghanistan. The U.S. withdrawal is complete. I think that is, you know, maybe the geopolitically the most significant headline. And so I think if you take that and the AUKUS agreement together, it does appear that there is a strategic reorientation from the US that really started in the Obama years.
Yeah, pivot to Asia.
The pivot to Asia that is now sort of finally becoming a reality.
Yeah.
And I think that comes along with, in theory and we hope in practice, a less reliance on the military, more reliance on, you know, the various diplomatic tools we have, but by necessity, a more cooperative stance toward the rest of the world. And that is by necessity because of the highest priority challenges we're facing, right? So there is some context around those kind of non-military challenges coming into the UNGA, as the blob calls it, as well.
We in the biz.
Which include, you know, so this I think is one of the last major international summits prior to the COP26 climate summit, which will be later this year in Glasgow. And there have just been consistently lowered expectations for that summit across the board.
Yeah. Right?
The ostensible goal of it is to take the next step beyond the Paris Agreement of 2015, which thankfully the US has now rejoined. But, you know, for everyone from, you know, developed countries like the UK to sort of more rising countries and emitters like India and China, has been already downplaying expectations for how much we'll really be able to accomplish there, which is wiggle room that we just frankly don't have.
It's unfortunate that the Earth only has one moon, because we really need two moonshots. I think getting out of COVID, or at least getting to where COVID is a more manageable part of our lives, is one of them. And I think almost as immediate, and certainly from a longer term perspective, more immediate, is the climate crisis.
Totally. And I don't think we are the first to point out the similarities and the similar need for international cooperation on those two fronts. But there was also some disheartening news on the international COVID response in the last week, where COVAX reduced its 2021 target for vaccine dose distribution from 2 billion by over 25% to 1.425 billion. Now, while you're seeing maybe some progress, or at least some evolution, on the stance of the US and its Western partners in terms of, you know, its defense and strategic orientation, I don't think you are seeing the US and the broader global community rise to meet the challenges that are existential that we're all facing together, at least in the lead up to this meeting.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one of the things that's happening on the sideline of UNGA this year is a COVID leader summit. I don't know what they're calling it officially, but it's essentially world leaders getting together to talk about COVID response. And I think the statistic that you cited of decreased COVAX sort of contributions to COVAX, I'm sure will come up.
Yeah.
I don't know if that figure is before or after India announced that they're going to start exporting the AstraZeneca vaccine again, now that they've gotten through their own tragedy. So it's, look, I think that we don't have a choice. We're going to have to figure this out. And I think getting back to the earlier part of our conversation, you know, countries like the US and lots of countries in Europe are going to have surpluses and have surpluses. And so it's a matter of trying to figure out how we can get those shots in arms.
And to your point, that dedicated summit on COVID response is happening as we record this podcast. So we don't have hot takes on it to deliver yet. What we can talk about is what happened on Tuesday this week, which was Biden's speech. So his first as president to the UN General Assembly. What jumped out at you as you were watching it?
I think what jumped out at me is what has jumped out at me about the whole UNGA. The focus is on COVID, the focus is on climate, and then Biden added this element of, you know, he wants democracies to be setting the global norms, not autocracies. I don't know if those are the exact words that he used, but that's essentially what he was saying. And so I think that you're seeing remarkable consistency in the Biden administration. And I think this gets to that point of, lots of people have expectations for what the Biden administration is going to do. And it's not a comparison to the Trump administration. It's sort of like, we think that this is what we, the blob, or we, the media, or we, the whatever, think that this is what needs to happen. And when Biden steps out of that, it's assumed that this was an error, a blunder. And in fact, on things like Afghanistan, as much criticism has been lobbed at them, justly and unjustly on Afghanistan, he's been remarkably consistent in that. He's been remarkably consistent for his at least sort of verbal support of things like democracy. And so I think that this was just sort of a greatest hits of that in true Joe Biden fashion. I think it was telling that people applauded the speech. I mean, that's the type of stuff that matters. I mean, Trump was laughed at when he spoke at the UN. And
I think the phrase that jumped out at me was he talked about relentless diplomacy as sort of the watchwords of what we pursue, and you know, using tools like diplomatic channels and aid networks and that sort of thing to influence and support other countries. What really stood out to me though was, and Biden has acknowledged this, right, that it is democracy's moment to prove it can get things done. Yep. And he does frame this democracy versus authoritarianism dichotomy that I think is really meaningful, because I don't think we are yet at a point where China offers a compelling ideological structure for the rest of the world in the way that communism did during the Cold War. But I do think pragmatically their system of, you know, rapid economic growth without really extending the freedoms that have had to come with that in the past under democracies to people is attractive to a lot of authoritarian leaders. And so I think Biden feels that he's up against that. But I think the rhetoric versus the reality on this is really concerning, where you just look at the cooperative priorities that Biden mentioned. It's a lot of things we talked about, right? Vaccines and global vaccine distribution, where we know that the U.S. could be doing more. Climate investments, where the infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better bill in Congress right now are looking really precarious. And if those don't get through, that's basically our last chance as a country for the foreseeable future, most likely to make any meaningful progress on combating climate change in the U.S. And he talked about our alliances as well. And we've talked about where things stand with France and how that has been going, and what was really an unforced error. So that all was just a bit of a red flag for me.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's worth considering that they're 9 months into their administration and that they have been trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again after 4 years of, you know, outright hostility towards the federal government. And I mean, the time for excuses is rapidly coming to an end, right? But I think that sometimes we forget that there was no transition, basically, because the Trump administration did not let them come in. And so on Inauguration Day, they walked in, most people across the federal government walked into scenarios across the federal government that they didn't know what was ahead of them. Compounding that, you have senators, primarily Republican senators, who are holding up nominations for the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, what they can control right now is the rhetoric. Mm-hmm. What they can do is scene set and put strategies in place. I think the implementation is just a lot harder because you're early in an administration and you don't have a whole lot of people, and you have a pretty obstinate Congress, even though it's sensibly in Democratic hands. And so I think that there's certainly a lot to push them on. And I think people are. I think this democracy versus autocracy piece is going to be a common theme. There's going to be a leaders summit on democracy later this year, or early next year, that is a first of its kind thing that Joe Biden himself is personally very passionate about. And China and Russia and others have sort of been able to exert global influence through their own communications and propaganda much without us. And we haven't really been able to push back really since the late 90s, since the U.S. Information Agency was disbanded under Bill Clinton. And so we haven't had the sort of ability to push back. And I think this is Biden's effort to be like, look, we are putting all of our chips behind democracy, and we want everybody to see that as a viable option for the future. Oh, by the way, we've got to deliver on vaccines, and we've got to deliver on climate and other stuff.
Yeah, where do you think the betting markets put the odds that we will actually elect an authoritarian in our next election?
I mean, I don't know if it's even, but it's probably like not low odds. Yeah,
we might have to switch the summit we go to. So thinking about the rest of this week, at the Unga. What else are you looking at
the
for?
The Unga. It's at Unga, Mike, at Unga.
Sure.
Getting to your point on rhetoric versus action, what are the commitments that are being made? Mm-hmm. We need to be watching. You know, China, to their credit, said that they're not gonna do coal power plants and coal related activities outside of China. They need to do that also inside China, but it's something to say that as part of Belt and Road and other kind of external efforts that they're not gonna do coal power. Like, not an insignificant thing.
Yeah.
The 70% of people being vaccinated, like, what are the actual commitments to that? What is the meat? What's the beyond the rhetoric? You know, it's sad that the COVAX had to bump down their target from 2 to 1.425 billion, but there at least was that commitment of 2 billion. These things are not, if we had just left it to the goodwill of people, there wouldn't have been 1.4 billion vaccines. There would have been far less. Mm-hmm. And so I think these commitments, even if they're not fully met, the commitments matter, because there's something that sort of the media and governments and citizens can hold people accountable to. So watch the commitments. And the last thing is super kind of wonky, but very interesting. So there's something called the, basically there's something called the Credentials Committee. And so there's two countries, Myanmar and Afghanistan, who have put forth representatives that so far the UN, well, the Myanmar has put one forth, and it's this military junta that, you know, basically staged a military coup in Myanmar, and the UN has said, no, we're fine with the representative that represented the previous government. So there's essentially this dissenting Burmese voice at the UN. It's a very interesting story. This person is very brave. And then you've got the Taliban just yesterday nominated their spokesman in Doha as their choice for UN representative. There is a UN representative from Afghanistan, again, representing the now deposed government. And so it just remains to be seen whether they're going to recognize the Afghan representative, and in doing so, recognize that Afghanistan is now governed by the Taliban. Right. The reason this is interesting, not just from a procedural perspective, Article 5, Article 6, all this other boring stuff, it's we have very little leverage over the Taliban. Mm-hmm. Recognition at the UN, which they so desperately want, is one of our points of leverage.
I get the American interest in that. From the standpoint of the UN, what is the case for not recognizing the Taliban in a situation where they are clearly running the government of Afghanistan and there is no meaningful alternative?
I think if UN agencies are still, especially humanitarian agencies, are still able to operate, which of course could be what the Taliban says, right? Like, they have some leverage here too, but their leverage is a lot less strong than our leverage, our meaning the UN and sort of international partners, because they need the UN. Their economy is crumbling. Mm-hmm. People are going to suffer, including people who are aligned with the Taliban. They know at a fundamental level that they need that humanitarian assistance. So it's unlikely that in the short term that they use that leverage. And so when you think about it from a UN perspective, first of all, nobody wants to be the first country or international entity that acknowledges the Taliban. China does not want to do that. Russia does not want to do that. Mm-hmm. And so that's a little bit of a chicken and egg game that's happening. And also just, I think this committee is going to be debating, you know, what's in it for the UN? You know, this is a government that's clearly in charge, but also has no record of protecting human rights and women and all of these other things. And I think that that's, to a lot of people, especially the same people who are holding strong on a Myanmar situation that's a lot less still problematic, but lost a lot less in the media and in the news in this part of the world. Yeah. The fact they're holding strong in that signals to me that it's probably not going to happen with the Taliban rep anytime soon.
Yeah. And any predictions of things that people aren't quite talking about yet that you think might come out of this week?
I think there's going to be
the hottest take of all.
The hottest take of all. No, I mean, look, there's always surprises. The speeches go on for 9 days. Decades ago, it was always everybody watched the Gaddafi speech because he would go on for 4 or 5 hours. And I think that remains to be seen, whether something comes out in the speeches. You know, Russia, China, I'm sure that the Chinese will mention the AUKUS agreement or they'll at least allude to it. You know, Biden didn't use the word China in his speech, but he did talk about Xinjiang. He didn't use the word Russia, but he did talk about Crimea. You know, there's certainly going to be some fireworks, but like rhetorical fireworks are not actually, you know, fundamental shifts usually. Mm-hmm. And so other than funding peacekeeping and whatever else the, you know, the General Assembly does, I don't anticipate there being too many curveballs other than the ones that we've talked about, which are pretty significant curveballs.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I think with the exception of my pronunciation of DC acronyms, Harold, I think we fixed it.
Definitely. UNGA for the win.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabuke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Wednesday, September 22nd, 2021 at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.